Hello and welcome back to the Long Distance Love Bombs podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, and my guest today is the wonderful Julie Christensen. She is a registered psychotherapist, multiple book writing author, former editor of a newspaper. She's got more than 25 years of experience in mental health counseling, seeing everybody from traumatic brain injury to employment counseling, all kinds of stuff. And this conversation is one of the favorite chats that I've had in quite some time. If you watch the video on YouTube, you will see my face very frequently, jaw wide open, eyes large like paper plates, staring off into space, thinking, dang, that is so good. Many times during this chat, I thought to myself, God, I wish I wrote that. I think I even interrupted Julie at some point to say that. But in this conversation, we talk somewhat primarily around her new book, which is called The Rise of Rage, Harnessing the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Ooh, there's so much good stuff in this conversation. We talk about how your feelings are liars, that your physiology is not your feeling. We talk about the distinction between competence and confidence. We talk about intermittent explosive disorder. And Julie gives this really clever framework for how to manage anger. And we talk about anger. We talk about so much good stuff. She is a wonderful resource. She is brilliant. She is fun. She's easygoing. I have a lot of time for Julie Christensen, and this is an incredible conversation that I know 100% you will learn something from. So thanks for being here. And without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Julie. Julie Christensen, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
It's always fun for me to have return guests because it sort of validates that I'm not a kook and that you want to come back and talk some more. So I appreciate you coming back.
It's so exciting to be with you again. I had so much fun the last time. I had even more fun when you came on my podcast, and I'm just excited to be here again.
Yeah, we were just chatting about things to talk about and how this will go, and we both agreed to just throw caution to the wind and start recording and see where the organic conversation flows. But I recall from our first conversation, and I wanted to actually ask you this because I wanted to make sure I remembered it right, but we talked all about anger. You had a great book about anger. You have a new book all about the rise of rage, which we're going to talk about. But I recall you saying something like anger in men manifests as violence, but in women it manifests as anxiety. Something like that. Did I screw that up?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. What was the line? Because I remember thinking it was such a good line.
Yeah. So we were talking about just the way that it manifests. And for women, mostly it shows up as depression, sometimes anxiety. So when women come in and they're like, oh, this is happening in my job and this is happening and this is happening in my job, and I'm really anxious and depressed, I'm like, are you? So I usually just, hand them a little assessment. I'm like, let's do this and let's see what's really going on here. So I think a lot of times they're angry, but they don't feel like they have permission to be angry. Whereas for men, their anxiety often shows up as anger.
Gotcha. So I completely wasn't
even close. They don't want to deal with their feelings, So when they're having a big feeling, it's easier to become aggressive and act it out that way than it is to say, I'm feeling really sad because my feelings are hurt. Like, that's just not the agency of men, right? At least the way that the culture dictates what's permissible and what's not. It's not okay for men to have big feelings and to express them in an intelligent, adult, mature way. But if they act out and they smash something, everybody's like, ooh, someone's having a bad day.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's the great sadness culturally and socially that we're experiencing. Or they just put a bullet in their head. Or they become addicts, right? So, So to clarify, so I have this right for our next conversation. anger can manifest in men as anxiety, and it can appear in women more commonly as depression.
Something like that.
All right. Yeah. Well, we're off to a flying, wobbly start here from my egoic perspective. Okay, but so for those listening that are like, okay, Anger Talk, Julie Christensen, I have no idea who this lady is. I have no idea what her deal is. How can you give a quick summary of what you're all about and who you are? I know you have a PhD. I know you're a therapist. You don't?
I do not.
I'm really screwing this entire interview up. Don't you have a doctorate?
The only person in this Zoom room with a PhD is Dr. Jeremy Goldberg.
No, you're Dr. Julie Christensen, I thought. Are you not?
I don't, no.
Oh my God.
Hopefully someone will give me an honorary degree. So I'm putting it out there into the universe.
Stop it. Who am I thinking of?
If you have the power to bestow on me an honorary PhD, I will happily come and accept it.
Julie, you can just use mine. I rarely use it except for like on my Instagram name. That's how often I use it now. You can just borrow it. I apologize. Who am I thinking of?
No apology needed.
All right. So, Julie, when I said that you could introduce yourself for the audience, what I really meant was, can you remind me of who you are, what you do? But did I have the therapist part right? Surely.
You do.
I remember that part.
Yeah, okay. You're one for two. So I am a registered psychotherapist in private practice. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology, and I've been working in the mental health space for about 30 years. I did exit mental health, you know, to preserve myself from burnout on a couple of occasions. I wandered the Northeastern United States and Canada for a couple of years as a professional public speaker. And, I've also worked in the media space as a staff writer for a business-to-business newspaper, editor-in-chief for another newspaper, and always found a way to come back to mental health because that's where my love is. So I have a private practice in psychotherapy that I've been running since about 2010. And I love to share my knowledge as it relates to self-help and anger resolution and all those things. So I write a lot. And as long as I'm writing books, I don't need to write for newspapers. So that's a win. I would rather write my own stuff than write for other people, to be truly honest. So I do a whole bunch of things that you guys would probably be really bored to hear about. But at the crux of it, I love people. I love communicating with people. I love helping people to improve their quality of life and to create radical, positive, lasting change in the areas that they're really struggling in. So that's what I'm about.
Yeah, I saw in your book, you've worked with basically every archetype of individual or issue or concern. Like you listed them in the introduction. It's like, dang, this lady's seen it all.
I've seen a lot. I won't say I've seen everything anymore because every time I say that, somebody comes into my office with a story and I'm like, oh, no, I should have just kept my mouth shut.
Yeah. And also you'd probably take a little note like this is great content for the next book, right?
Yeah.
But so one like very generic question that I had, and I thought it would be just a jumping off point, and we could take this wherever you'd like the whole conversation. Like if you want to talk about gardening and carrots, like that's cool. But I was curious, like how you differentiate between anger and rage, because it seemed like the first book was more about anger, but this one's called The Rise of Rage. And as I was flipping through it, it seemed like there is an overlap, and I'm just intrigued as to how you define or differentiate those.
So I wouldn't differentiate them. I would say that anger as a basic emotion runs on a continuum like every other emotion does. So if you think about happiness, when someone says, how are you doing? You know, if you're having really a spectacular day, you've been for a hike, you've got to skinny dip in the water somewhere, and you've had an amazing day and you're invigorated and all the things, you're not going to be like, yeah, doing all right. You know, that's not going to be your response. Doing all right is still on the happiness continuum. It's just on the low end. You're going to be higher up on the continuum, and you're going to have a different word for how you're feeling in that moment. If tonight you follow the lotto and you see that you've won $53 million, you're probably going to be somewhere up in the ecstatic range of happiness, not the content range of happiness. If you win $5, well, I've got back the price of my ticket. I'm content. But I just won $53 million. That's a whole different level of happiness, but it's still happiness, right? And so what we've done as human beings is we have developed different words to describe the intensity of the emotion that we're feeling. Rage is still anger. It's just a higher intensity of anger than, say, frustration or irritation. Still on the angry continuum. Disappointed, whatever. But it's still, I'm still mad about it. It's just, how mad are you about it? Do I use the word rage? Do I use the word livid? Do I use the word fury? Each of those words carries with it a certain measure of weight, right? And intensity. So that's really all it is.
I really like that. I hadn't considered it to be as simple an explanation as that. Of like, oh, it's just an adjective, essentially, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And then I suppose part of your work is helping people to identify what they're feeling and then match the appropriate descriptor. Okay, so those that are listening, I got a double finger point just now for that. So maybe you want to say more about that?
I will, yeah. It is so, so important because, I don't know, maybe you just want to do this exercise for me, Jeremy, right now, and maybe the audience can do it at the same time. Okay. So I'd like you to close your eyes, and I'd like you to think about a time when you were feeling really, really happy, like you're on the high end of the happiness continuum, and you're somewhere in joy. Maybe not ecstasy, but joy is a good word. So you're feeling really joyful and you're feeling really wonderful. And I want you to let that expression come over your face. No one can see you. We're on the radio. Right? So let that expression come over your face. And as you're feeling joyful and just full of happiness, I want you to say with as much intensity as you can muster, I am so depressed.
I am so depressed.
And do you feel what your face is doing in that moment?
My face is smiling very largely, and it is in so much conflict with those words coming out of my mouth.
Yeah. And so a lot of times when people do this and they say it with real intensity, the muscles in their face literally try to pull out of the smile.
Yeah.
You know, you can feel it kind of like doing this thing where they start twitching and tugging because they're trying to match the intensity of the word depressed.
Yeah, right? I felt like my cheeks were fighting with my lips.
Yes. Yeah. So when you're smiling, if you were truly sad and depressed, that would leak out in your facial expressions. You could fake the smile, but it wouldn't reach your eyes. There would be signs, if we're looking for them, there would be signs that you are actually quite sad because your body cannot lie, right? And if you say you are depressed with enough intensity and you say it enough, your body will literally just take on the physiology of that emotion. So it's really important that we choose our words wisely. I'm always irritated by teenagers in particular, you know, and young adults who, when I was a professor, they would be like, oh, I only got a 55 on my exam. I'm so depressed. I'm like, stop it. Stop. You're not depressed. You're disappointed. Use the right word. You know, like, why do you want to put yourself in a state of depression because you did poorly on an exam? Study harder. That's all it is, right? Like, this is no reason for you to need to go out and go get some Wellbutrin. Like, just study harder. Accept the fact that you're disappointed in yourself. Use that language and your body will respond. But if you keep saying, I'm so depressed, I'm so depressed, I'm so depressed, you will literally put yourself into that state, even if you were not experiencing a chemical depression prior to that.
So this idea, it sounds like, is that words are powerful things.
Power, yeah.
I was just remembering a study that they did where they put pencils in people's mouths. Are you familiar with that?
No, tell me
about it. Okay. Like, and now I really don't trust my memory based on our introduction, but my recollection is that I'll try to do this on video, but if you take a pen and you put it, what do they do? Like, it had people try to smush it up to their nose, so they made a frowny face, or they had it like in their teeth, so they made a smiley face, and then they asked them questions about their emotional state or how they're feeling and whatnot. And basically, what I'm remembering is that if you just make the expression of a smile, then your emotional state will follow that physical act, even if when you initiated the act of smiling, you weren't feeling happy or content or joyful. And it sounds like that's what you're saying here is if you say, I'm depressed, I'm sad, I'm miserable, I suck, then your body will start to take on that state to match it.
Yeah, your body will respond in kind. So even when you say a word like, oh, this happened to me and I was so furious. I mean, the moment we say the word furious, our body starts to do this. You know, it starts to clench and it starts to tighten up because fury has... it carries a certain physiological marker, right? Clenched teeth, tightened fists, you know, all the muscles are clenched and tightened up because fury implies you're ready to fight. People who are furious don't run away. You know, when fight or flight kicks in, fury says, I'm fighting you, right? So it takes on that stance. Whereas a different measure of anger might produce something else. So I have this funny story I have to tell you. If you feel like cutting this, be my guest.
No. But before, hang on, just before that funny story, I just want to add, the heavyweight boxing champion, his last name is Fury. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
His name's Tyson Fury. And when you said like people that are furious want to fight, I was just thinking, oh, like I wonder if that has had some kind of implication growing up. As literally your name is Fury, you're Mr. Fury.
Yeah.
He became a boxing champion.
Oh, there you go.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt, but please.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I got kind of caught up in a rabbit hole last night, Jeremy, watching these videos on Instagram. The feed I believe is called My Milo or something like that. So it's this gentleman and he has what he calls a talking dog. So he's basically developed these mats with buttons that he records different words on, and he's taught the dog how to choose the buttons that he wants to, so he can communicate with his humans. Like, it's fascinating.
Okay.
So he's taught the dog how to say that he's mad. So when the dog is upset about something, he'll just walk over to the mat and he'll press a button and it says mad, and then he'll actually say why. So apparently in one of the videos, they were coming home from somewhere and there was a strange dog in their yard, and Milo went bananas in the car, barking, and he wouldn't calm down. They wouldn't let him out of the car until this dog walked away and left the property. And so this was in the front yard, so Milo goes over to the mat and he hits the mad button, and then he hits the button that says front yard. And then he hits the button that says front door. So his owner comes in and goes, what are you talking about? Like, you can go out back if you want to go to the washroom. And he's like, front yard. So he looks out and he looks at the front yard, and the dog comes right to the door, and he looks out the door and he starts barking. And he looks at Milo and he says, Milo, you need to learn forgiveness. That dog is gone. Right. They're having a full-on conversation. That dog is gone. That was hours ago. You need to get over it. And Milo goes back over to the mat and hits a button and goes, bruh.
And says, what? Bro?
Bruh. I was done. I'm like, this dog is way too smart. But, I mean, he shows these videos to show us that dogs actually, number one, feel emotion, and number two, understand way more of what we're saying than what we understand. But I just thought it was really amusing that the dog was like, I'm still ticked off about that animal being in my territory earlier, you know, mad. Like, it just goes over the button, mad.
I love that you're like, what's the verb for, you're like giving therapy to the dog, or like analyzing the dog, right? It's like, oh, the dog is in the anger response, and the dog's very self-aware. And I picture going into your office and you have that tool as well.
I would love to have Milo as a therapy dog.
No, I mean the like where you push the button and it says like Jeremy, how are you feeling? And I'm like, punched down, angry.
That would be that would be great.
I mean, it sounds like the dog has more self-awareness than many individuals in the world. Like certainly more than I did, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Okay, so when people are trying to figure out where they're stuck or blocked, or I just did a post a couple of days ago where I said that I was just in the muck or in the mud for a couple of days, and you're just kind of like angsty and whatnot. Do you have any tricks to help us sort of get through that or get out of that?
Yeah, I think the first thing is what you said about self-awareness. You know, we really need to pay attention to what's going on with ourselves. And I have a couple of little tricks, and perhaps I will just go right into the book to make sure that I get it right. And don't, you know, just say a whole bunch of garbage that I didn't actually write down.
It would be weird if you misquoted yourself.
What's that?
If you misquoted yourself, it would be a little
bit. Yes, that would be bad. So I do have something in here. I'm trying to think of where exactly I put it. But just in terms of how we can assess what's going on and make some change right off the bat. And the first thing is that we have to acknowledge what's going on. And usually when we're in the weeds or in the muck, like you say, we have this, you know, I can't find it. It's fine. I'll work from memory. We have this way of indulging in habits. So they're either sort of, you know, nail biting or, you know, chewing on your bottom lip or whatever, fidgeting. We have these things that we do to indicate that things are not okay. We don't even realize we're doing them. They're self-soothing behaviors. Sometimes we just get caught up in intrusive thoughts and we entertain those. And so they feed that mood, you know, that I don't feel so good. And we think thoughts that contribute to the mood instead of pull us out of it. So the first thing is just to acknowledge, oh, I'm in that pattern again. I see myself doing this. I hear the thoughts that I'm thinking and I realize that they're not helping me in this moment. I see that I've bitten my nails down to the quick one more time, you know, or I'm chewing on my cuticles or whatever that might be. So first thing is we acknowledge and we accept that that's what's happening in the moment. Because one of the things I write about in the book is this notion of positive acceptance that comes from Graham Price. And what Graham Price says is that we prolong our distress by wishing that things were already different. So if I'm chewing on my nails and I'm saying, man, I wish I could stop this habit. While I'm chewing on my nails, I'm actually adding to my distress because right now I am not getting rid of this nasty habit. I am indulging in it. Okay. So I'm actually going to make myself feel worse because I'm wishing I could stop right now and I'm not stopping. Right. Because right now in this moment, I'm right in the middle of it. So instead, I'm just going to accept the fact that I'm actually chewing my nails to the quick right now. It's not okay, but it's not not okay. It just is. Mm. And if I can accept it without judgment, then I can look past this moment into the future and say, what can I do instead? Right? But before I get to that place, I need to do an assessment. So the first thing is to acknowledge. The second is to accept. The third thing is I'm going to do a quick little assessment. And the assessment that I have in the book is called blasts with an S at the end. Bored, lonely, angry, sad, tired, or something else. Right? Blast. Bored, lonely, angry, sad, tired, something else. I'm just going to run through it. Okay, am I bored? If I'm bored, why don't I find something to do? You know, if I'm lonely, why don't I call a friend? If I'm angry, why don't I try to solve the problem that made me angry? If I'm sad, maybe I just need to cry and get it out of my system. Or maybe I can journal, or maybe I can go talk to somebody who will make me feel better. And if I'm tired, why don't I rest? You know, like it's if I just identify the problem that is feeding the behavior, now I can go into resolution mode. But as long as I sit there going, man, I hate the fact that I bite my nails. I wish I could stop. I wish I could stop. And all the while I'm chewing on them, I'll never get past that. Mm. So acceptance really is sort of the linchpin that moves us into the process of assessment. And once I've figured out what it is, now I can adapt my behavior and choose to do something that's more healthy. So I think that's a useful tool that people can use when they find themselves sort of mired in yucky emotions that they don't really want to be experiencing. This is how we can leverage ourselves out of them.
Mm. Yeah, and it continues on with the power of words that we talked about a moment ago of like, oh, this is actually what's going on. And I think for me, at least, I've written about this idea that clarity is the antidote to anxiety in some regard, because I'll be feeling in the muck or stuck or frozen or grumpy, or I call them the want-wahs. I'm like, Kendra, I got the want-wahs. I don't know what's going on, right? And so there's this kind of anxiety that occurs in my system when I'm uncertain of what's happening. And I'm a little bit lost and I'm like in the dark. But to your point, it sounds like when you can go through this blast little checklist and identify with a bit more clarity what's going on. And it's like, oh, I'm tired. I need to like lay down for 20 minutes. I'm like, oh, I'm angry. I need to go move my energy. I need to go whatever. Whatever you would suggest for any anger release, right? And it also, just the second point, reminds me of this great talk by Alain de Botton years ago. And he talks about relationships and love and how one of the ways that we can really enhance our relationships is to just treat our significant other as if they were a toddler. Like, oh, do you need to sleep? Do you need a snack? Did you poop your pants? Like, do you need to poop? Like, what's going on? And like really simplifying life down to that. So, okay. So then the acceptance, the identification through the BLAST system, and then it sounds like the next step is to take action in some regard to address that.
Mm-hmm.
That's so clever.
Yeah.
And
It makes sense to me, because it's like I often get into that headspace where I'm just, you know, I start on a narrative. And in the beginning, and this is really weird, maybe you can relate to this, that in the beginning, even though the narrative is very sort of self-serving and it's pity party language, somehow it's gratifying. Right? It's rewarding. Oh, people treat me so bad. You know, like I'm doing all the right things and I still get the shaft and da-da, you know, and we run this thing down, this narrative. And it is self-serving until it's not. And then it becomes, you know, then the emotions start to bubble up and we're feeling really lousy. And a lot of times I don't even realize that I'm feeling lousy because I've been writing the narrative. And so then I wake up and I'm feeling terrible and I'm unmotivated and I don't want to go to work. And, you know, all these things are going, and I'm like, why am I feeling like this? And that is a bad question. Because if I ask myself, why am I feeling lousy? What my brain hears is, I'm lousy. Why do I feel this way? And then it goes and finds all the evidence for why I'm lousy and presents it at my feet, like a, you know, like an adoring dog that just killed its fourth rat for you, you know, like, here you go. And it's like, no, I don't want proof that I'm lousy. I need help to get out of this mindset. So asking ourselves questions, why am I always depressed? Why am I so sad? Why can't I ever get anything right? Why? Those are bad questions. We need to ask ourselves questions like, what can I do to create a future that feels better than this present? You know, so if I can accept the present that I'm in right now, then I can take the edge off. I don't need to ask why I'm feeling this way because I've accepted that I'm feeling this way. And now I can just look to the future and say, well, do I want to feel this way tomorrow? No. Do I want to feel this way later? No. So what can I do? What steps can I take? How can I adapt my mindset, or how can I adapt my behavior so that my emotions respond in a different way moving forward from here?
That's so powerful, to ask better questions. Dang. And I was reflecting on how the opposite seems to be true of like the positive psychology movement or the affirmations that people recommend, or be it until you are it, right? And so if you would phrase the question perhaps, and please shoot this idea down if it's inappropriate or ridiculous, but you know, why am I blessed right now? Why am I grateful right now? Why am I the opposite of lousy right now? Mm-hmm. And it seems like the brain will also go find meaning for that. Of like, absolutely. Oh, like
it will.
X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, it will, absolutely. And I want to speak to that notion of fake it till you make it, if I can. I had a really interesting conversation with a client just a couple of weeks ago around that. And they were saying, yeah, I'm just going to fake it till I make it. And I said, no, you're not going to fake it. Because faking it implies that you don't have it. And you do, right? It's not that you lack the competency. What you lack is the confidence. And this is something I've written about before, just on my Instagram and whatnot, that competence is not confidence. Confidence is not competence. I can be completely competent in my ability to drive a car, but if I've been traumatized because of a car accident, I may not feel that I can drive. And it's not that I can't actually turn the car on, put it in gear, press the gas, steer the car, and do it safely. It's that I don't feel confident, right? So fake it till you make it. It's a great catchphrase. But I think what it does is it reinforces this notion that we are not competent, when in fact we are. We just need to build our confidence. And so what I've encouraged my clients to do is to do it until you feel confident. It's not as catchy as fake it till you make it, but it's more accurate, right? Again, words have power. So I think when I say, well, I'm just going to fake it, what I'm saying is I'm going to pretend to be something that I'm not. And I have to hold space for the fact that I am not that in order to pretend that I am that when I'm not, right? So instead of me holding space to try and affirm that I am not what I actually am, why don't I just accept that I am that, but I'm having a little bit of imposter syndrome, or I'm feeling a little insecure, and work on my insecurity rather than denying my competency.
That's so good. When you said that bit about competence versus confidence, I was like, damn, I wish I wrote that. Like, that's a banger.
You can borrow it.
That is a banger line. Ah, dang.
I don't know one of those things and frame it for me.
Yeah. God, I love that. Because it's such a subtle and powerful distinction to recognize that, oh, I've got this. I just don't feel like I've got this.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah. And I'm always telling my clients, feelings lie. Feelings lie. And so
No, Julie, I've been on Instagram and I read that your body never lies, and that your brain is the arbiter of truth, and that your intuition is divine and always accurate.
That may be so. But none of those things are feelings. Your physiology is not your feelings. Right?
Dang, that's another good line. You've come with the heat today.
You caught me at a good time. This is like the witching hour for my brain. This is when I do my best work.
Your physiology is not your feelings.
Oof. It's not. Your physiology responds to your feelings, right? But your intuition is not your feelings. Your feelings are an emotional response to stimuli in your environment. So when you get into the mindset, and your feelings respond very closely to your thought patterns. So mindset matters. If you are constantly speaking negative things into your existence, your feelings will respond in kind, and then your feelings will take over and say, oh, you can't do it. You can't do it. Nobody cares about you. Nobody loves you. Look how lonely you are. Look how alone you are. There's nobody out here to support you. Those are lies. Those are lies. Our feelings lie to us all the time. And then our bodies kick in because they're responding to our feeling state. And then we go, but the body's never wrong. Well, the body isn't wrong. The body is just doing whatever you tell it to do. Right? Stop telling it stupid stuff. I know that's not, that doesn't sound very literary, but that's the reality, right? We tell ourselves, we repeat these narratives that are, like I said, they're self-serving, but they're you know, language full of self-pity or self-loathing or insecurity, whatever it is. And we repeat the narrative until our bodies buy in and they follow, you know, they follow suit to whatever narrative we're speaking into existence. And then we go, oh, see, like, look, right? The body doesn't lie. And it's like, oh my goodness, wait a second. But you lied to your body.
Ooh, nobody wants to hear that, though. That means you have to take responsibility for your life.
Yes, you do.
Dang, I love this so much. Your physiology is not your feelings. And I'm thinking about how these individual thoughts sort of scale, right? And then they form beliefs, and the beliefs form personality. And the personality, if you do that long enough, that's your identity. And then once it's in an identity, it's pretty well encrusted and in concrete, and you've kind of created this hardened matrix within you that you exist.
Yes.
And what you're saying, I think, is to like make better choices and tell yourself better stories.
Yes. And we have to be intentional about it. We cannot afford, we could never afford, but more now than ever, we cannot afford to live our life on autopilot. We just can't. We've got to be intentional. We've got to be mindful. We have to pay attention to the things that we say to ourselves. We have to be pay attention to the things that we say to other people. We have to be careful that we are not speaking things into existence that we don't want for ourselves or others, right? Mm-hmm. The days where you could just get up, wander into the kitchen, cook your eggs, drink your coffee, you know, drive to work, get to work and forget how you even got there. You don't even remember the commute. Those days are long gone, man. Like we got people getting out of their cars on the 401 in rush hour traffic and beating the snot out of each other. Okay. Like those days are over. You cannot afford to be on autopilot because you don't know what's coming for you. You gotta be awake, right?
Yeah.
We've got to pay attention if we want to have really decent quality of life. And to be able to have those amazing relationships that we say we want, we've got to do the work.
Amen. I mean, this all sounds great. And I think that's why, in theory, people are listening right now. Like, okay, I'm doing the work. I'm learning new things. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you a very random question? This came up as I was reading through your book, which you were very gracious in sending me an advance copy. But what is, because I read this and I laughed out loud. I was like, what the hell is that? I've never heard that. What is intermittent explosive disorder?
Yeah.
That's a great name for something, but.
It is. So intermittent explosive disorder is what the psychologist or the psychiatrists decided they wanted to call dysregulated anger.
Which is like outbursts of like violence and vitriol and nonsense or like?
Well, it's very specific. So I'm going to pull up the...
definition.
When I first learned about it, and I write about this in the book, when I first learned about it, I was like, are you kidding me? They just gave anger a name so that they could medicate it. That was my mindset, right? Like if we can give it an actual name and a disordered name, then when people go to their doctor and say, you know, I keep outbursting all the time, I'm constantly angry, they can go like, here's a drug for it, and the pharmaceuticals win, right? That was my mindset. So here's how they've defined it. IED, intermittent, and it's very witty, you know, like they were like, oh, they'll call it an IED, just like whatever. it's a disorder of behavior regulation, a subtype of impulse control disorder. So the characteristics are poor impulse control, unruly volatile expressions of anger, aggression, and or rage, sometimes accompanied by violence, not always.
So it sounds like the sort of stereotypical description of the the typically male partner that is emotionally repressed and non-communicative, and then suddenly snaps because they stubbed their toe or the light was left on and all hell breaks loose. Is that a, that's a very
Yeah, you could put it like that. I mean, it's the person who really just doesn't know what to do with their big feelings because they probably never were taught. There may be something organic going on there in terms of, you know, brain chemistry or whatever, brain injury, perhaps. You know, if people suffer a brain injury when they're quite young, then, you know, depending on where the brain injury occurs, they might not develop the ability to have really good impulse control. And so it carries on throughout their adult lives. For some people, it's brought on by alcohol, you know, right? You know, you hear of people who are the angry drunks, like they're perfectly lovely when they're sober, but then they get a little inebriated and the inhibitions are gone and then they lose their ability to control their impulses. So it's, you know, quick response without really thinking things through. Sometimes there's aggression, sometimes there's violence, but a lot of times it's just like a volatile response to something that really isn't that big of a deal. They just don't know how to regulate.
Yeah, I think your description evokes compassion and empathy from the way I'm hearing it. It's like, oh, maybe there was a physiological impact when they were younger and their brain just isn't hardwired to deal with this. Or maybe they haven't learned, nobody's taught them how to deal with these big feelings and what to do with that. Rather than what I see typically online, especially, is it's like judgment, criticism, shame, etc. And like that, shame's never helped anybody.
No, no. I'm not a fan of weaponizing shame. This is another thing that I write about in the book.
I mean, it would be so awkward if you were, as a highly intellectual therapist, if you just came on here and were like, you know what, I want to talk about weaponizing shame. It's the best. I love it. Huge fan.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's just, it's icky, right? Like, And shame shows up in almost every aspect of our culture. You know, we see it all the time, especially with the advent of social media and public shaming. There's a guy on Instagram that I still haven't decided if I like him or I despise him, because he's calling out people and he's getting the police to take action on things that they should have taken action on without his intervention. But it's still public shaming. And I'm like, is this the new vigilante, you know, that just sits armchair quarterbacks vigilanteism from his chair and outs people on Instagram and then says, if you live in this community, tell me who this is. You know, like that's great in one way. But again, I'm like, is this where we want to go? Do we just want to sit back, you know, behind the anonymity of our screens and call people out for things that we're probably doing, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. How do you see, like, if you had to design a society or a government or a culture of some kind whereby anger and rage and all of those kinds of words were healthy and respected and integrated, like, what would that look like?
I would start with the education system. And I would start in kindergarten. Actually, I would start with the teachers. Obviously, we have to start with the staff because they have to all be on board. But really where I would start would be teaching the little ones that what you feel and what you do are not the same thing. It's okay for you to be mad. You know, it's okay for you to be angry, but it's not okay for you to hit other people. It's okay for you to be mad, but it's not okay for you to throw this toy across the room. So your behavior is unacceptable, but your feelings are valid. I think we need to start there because we're too quick to just punish children for their behavior. We punish them for acting out and they don't have the ability to make the distinction between what they feel and what they do. They need an adult to teach them that. So if we don't, what they come away thinking is that my feelings are not acceptable because I did this to express my feelings and I got punished for it. So my feelings are therefore bad. So we need to start there. I would normalize therapy in school. I would actually in public school up to grade 7, I would be teaching pro-social behavior, teaching children how to problem solve effectively together rather than bullying each other to get their needs met. I'd teach them, you know, all of that. I would make sure that every school provided counseling services for kids, because most of the problems we have in the world, in my opinion, are because we have adverse childhood experiences that were unresolved. And so if we can provide space for kids to resolve their adverse childhood experiences before they graduate high school, we wouldn't have the dropout rates in the first year of college that we have. Right? So if we made, in Ontario, we have mandatory volunteer hours that need to be fulfilled before a student can graduate high school. They've got to do 40 hours of community service. So why not also make it mandatory for every student to have 40 hours of therapy before they graduate high school?
Whoa.
Why not do that? Right? Then they can talk about the time that their stepdad touched them inappropriately when they were 5. And they can do that in a safe space. They can talk about the boy that made them have sex when they weren't ready when they were 13 or 15. They can talk about, you know, the abusive parent or that time that they witnessed an accident. They've never been able to talk to anybody about it because everybody would think that they're the P word. You know, like all of these things, right? That they can talk through whatever that adverse experience or that trauma was. What about foster kids who are shipped from home to home with only a garbage bag carrying all their stuff? What if they had access to 40 hours of therapy before they graduated high school? Perhaps more of them would go to university and college. Right? Perhaps more of them would make better decisions about their future, and they wouldn't repeat the generational trauma that they experienced as children. So I'm a huge advocate of that. And then I think when students go to college and university, that we would continue that conversation and normalize therapy for them, because it's a huge transition. The freshman 15 is real, right? They go to school, they're drinking all this alcohol, they're, you know, they're partying it up, they're using their OSAP money to go eat at restaurants all the time and doing all this stuff. They're not really focused on their education, and then they realize they're on academic suspension, and they've got to try and explain to their parents what happened. And there are all of these other factors. They're getting into relationships, they're experiencing breakups, they're getting cheated on, you know, all of these things. And the onset of mental health or onset of mental illness, often happens between the ages of 18 and 36. So now you've got these students who are going into that high risk part of their lives. And if there's a genetic predisposition for that, then all of the stress that they're experiencing in their first year of college or university, that will be the time when you're going to start to see symptoms come up. So why not make counseling and therapy more accessible to those students, right? And if it's been normalized all the way through public school and high school, it's a no-brainer. I don't feel good. I'm having some big feelings. I don't know what to do with this. Maybe I should go talk to the counselor. Right. It won't be something shameful. They'll just go do it because they've been taught that it's okay for them to do that. Dang. That's a long answer, but that's what I would do.
It's so interesting. Those watching would have seen my face when you said, what if you needed 40 hours of therapy to graduate high school? That's just such an interesting thought experiment. I'd never considered that.
I would really love for a school to come forward and say, we will partner with you on this and we'll test it. I would love to do that, because I think it would make, I know what it would have done for me, right? I did 5 years of high school because it was before they did away with the OAC program in Ontario. And I'll tell you what, my first year of high school, my second year of high school, I can't tell you how often I thought, I just throw myself off a bridge. You know, like I was actively looking for ways to harm myself in my first year, 2 years of high school, and no one knew, right? I was incredibly depressed. I was lonely. I had a friend group, but I didn't fit in with my friend group, and I knew that I didn't fit in with them because they told me so. And, you know, like it was hard. I know that for me, if I had, even in grade 9, if I had had someone say, you have to go see a therapist in order to graduate, I would have done it. And I would have been able to resolve all the stuff that happened in public school, right? Because I emigrated to Canada at the age of six with my parents, or immigrated to Canada at the age of six. I was reading at a grade three level at 6 years old, but because I talked with an accent, they figured I thought with an accent and they put me in kindergarten. So I was bored out of my ever-loving mind, okay? Because I knew all this stuff. I was reading chapter books, you know, Lassie and Little House on the Prairie, and they were giving me See Jane Run, See Dick Run. What the heck, right? So I was just like, what are you doing here? And so, you know, in terms of, you know, experiencing systemic racism for the first time as a child, I took piano lessons when we came to Canada, and the woman used to beat me when I made a mistake. And that's why I stopped piano lessons, because I was like, I'm not coming to piano so I can be abused by this woman who wants to whip me with the meter stick every time I make a mistake on the piano, right? And then moving every couple of years, having to change friends, learning a new community, moving to a community where there was overt racism because they had never seen Black people before. Like, I have all of that stuff in there, right? And if someone had said, let's unpack this together, let's unpack your experience of learning that a person that your family was really close to completed suicide when you were 12. Let's unpack that. Let's unpack all of these things. Let's unpack the fact that one of your first boyfriends got hit by a car and almost died. You know, like, let's just unpack all this stuff, right? I think I would have been a much healthier person by the time I graduated high school. And I wouldn't have, you know, my learning arc wouldn't have been so long. You know, I would have, I think it would have given me a head start on my life in a lot of ways if I'd had that. So I always consider that when I look at what kids are going through in school today, with the overt bullying and cyberbullying and sexual assaults and roofies and, you know, it's just all of this stuff. It would be nice if there was someone who would say, you know what, it is okay for you to unpack that stuff. I'll make it safe for you to do so.
I'm just loving this. Thank you for sharing so openly. This is one of those moments that I've often discussed where I just forget that I'm hosting a podcast and I just feel like I'm watching a great TED talk happen. Like, go Julie. And like, gosh. But I just, yeah, my heart goes out to you. And it's interesting to me how all of those adverse childhood experiences form and fester inside of you and then lead you to become this incredible educator, therapist, expert. So it seems like the classic example of turning pain into purpose, or, you know, healing the thing that you are most fed up with the world, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we need to get you a school as a pilot project so you can go and implement this.
Somebody reach out to me. I'm down, man. Like, I'll make time to make that happen. Because I think I'm so passionate about that. I work with so many kids who are really struggling with school because they're being bullied, because they have stuff going on at home that nobody knows about. They're mourning, they're grieving losses that people will not understand, or at least they believe people will not understand. We also have a generation of young parents who are falling down on the parenting job, you know, for lack of a better way to say it. You know, we've got parents that go to McDonald's every day to buy their kid lunch instead of making them a lunch that's filled with love, you know, a sandwich, a juice box, a granola bar, and a fruit. That's not hard. But I would rather go to McDonald's because I'm not that invested. And the kids can feel it, right? They carry all of that with them. We have kids now going into schools that have a zero touch policy. So they are devoid of touch all day long. They don't know, they're not getting like just the natural way that children touch each other throughout the day. That's not allowed. And so the only touch they're getting is from their parents before they go to school and from their parents after they get home from school. And they're acting out because they're needing that connection and they're not getting it. So all of these little things are adding up to the behavioral problems that we're seeing with children in school. And one of the studies I found saw that even just in the COVID year, just in 2020, the amount of violence that occurred from teachers, from students to teachers and school administrators increased exponentially. And then the violence from parents to teachers and school administrators also increased exponentially during the COVID year, because everybody was frustrated at the fact that they had to work from home. Mm. And so when there was contact, it was an expression of frustration rather than "I'm so happy to see you and to be here in this space," you know?
That intermittent explosive disorder.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, but what is it? I mean, I think I know the answer, but when an entire culture or society exhibits symptoms of that, right? I think it's speaking to what you were talking about earlier of this is a systemic issue. And these individuals are coming up through no fault of their own. These children are raised in troubling times in such a way where they're not getting access to X, Y, and Z. And then they leave the comfort and security of their home to go off and study at college, whereby they're overwhelmed. There is no support system. There's drinking, there's drugs, there's sex. And things start to come up that weren't addressed years and decades before.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything starts to unravel, you know, and it doesn't take much. You just got to pull on one little thread and then the whole thing just starts to come apart. And, you know, we have this mythology around campus life, that campus life is the partying and it's, you know, it's the freedom and you get a credit card because you got these sharks, you know, selling credit cards to students on their first day of school. They're like, "I got a credit card. I can spend all this money." And they don't, you know, they don't have financial literacy and they haven't learned these things that will help them really be successful in the world. And so, you know, there are many who are quite resourceful who will figure it out, but then there's always that percentage that's going to struggle because they either don't have the resourcefulness or they don't have the built-in resiliency. Or they just, you know, they were so focused on academics that they never learned how to navigate the world socially. There are all of these factors that contribute to what would constitute failure in that first year of college and university, because they weren't ready. They weren't ready for it.
And so then that leads to the rise of rage, would one say?
Which from
everything that you've just discussed so eloquently and so clearly, it makes complete sense that rage would happen. It makes sense that it would be manifested in that way, given all of the things that we've talked about.
If I find myself in a situation that I'm not equipped for, emotionally, intellectually, educationally, whatever it is, I'm not equipped for this, but I'm expected to fake it till I make it. I know I don't have the competency, nor do I have the confidence. So I'm really out here sort of floundering and I'm looking around for supports, but the supports are so well hidden that I don't know where to find them. And I probably wasn't paying much attention when we had that tour of the campus, because I was too excited about the fact that I was going to be away from my parents, you know, like, how do we get that back? You know, how do we rescue it before it goes so far? And I mean, I write about in the introduction of the book, how many students had like major, major breakdowns, psychotic breaks, full on hallucinations, delusions, screaming, like, meltdowns in my classes, or, you know, outside of my classes while I was trying to teach. And I was just like, is this happening because they know that this is a safe space, or is this happening all over this campus right now and nobody knows what to do about it? Like, what's going on here? You know, as a psychology professor, I had a better toolbox. But the other thing is that the school was very clear: if you're a teacher, you're not a therapist. So if a student is having a problem, you send them to student services. You are not to deal with it yourself, because that would be, you know, like a dual relationship, right? You can't be a therapist and a teacher to the same student. So even though I had the skill set, my hands were fairly tied. I couldn't do what I knew to do because it would be a breach of academic ethics, in effect, right? So I really do feel like we need to do a better job of supporting our students, but we can't start at the college level. We've got to start in elementary school and in high school. If we can't start in elementary, by the time they get to high school, the counselors are going to have their work cut out for them, because bullying peaks in grade 7, right? And if we don't nip it in the bud in grade 7, those bullies are going to go on to high school and they're going to cause like lasting damage, right? How many people, I'm sure you can think, if you just run through the people you went to high school with, but yeah, you can probably identify at least 2 who experienced lifelong damage because of the bullying they experienced in high school.
For sure. Or just clients or friends or loved ones, et cetera.
Yeah.
So given your history / experience in university life as a therapist, and given the spectrum that you defined earlier, let's say a new spectrum of concern, from everything's fine, we're doing great, all the way to completely freaking out, eyes bugging out, waving your arms like, this is not okay. Where do you lie on that spectrum of concern now compared to, like, say, 10, 20 years ago, or whenever it was that you sort of started really paying closer attention to all of this stuff?
I think I'm closer to the waving my hands in the air, freaking out level than I was before. Because I didn't see the trend. You know, it took me a while. Sometimes I'm a little slow on the uptake. I maybe don't sound like that today, but sometimes a little slow to catch on to things. And it took a while for me to see how the policies of the school boards were interpreted by the teachers, and how the school administrators would often say the right things but not do the right things, and how there was a lack of accountability. And so a lot of the times, the students that were of real concern in terms of their mental health because of what they were experiencing were just sort of left out there twisting in the wind with no real support. It took me a few years to figure that out. It also took me a few years to notice similar trends in the working world. And so by the time, I guess it was probably around 2011, I was working on a project with Lori Flasco, and we wrote the book Bullying Is Not a Game. And that's when I sort of dove headfirst into the research and went, oh, this is a problem. Like, I knew it was a problem, but now it's like problem with a capital P, you know? And doing the research there and going to the school boards and getting, you know, their 3-inch thick binders that have all the policies and procedures and things for bullying. And I'm like, who knows about these? Do the teachers know about these? Do the school admins know about these? And they're like, no, we have it here. So, you know, it's a reference point, but they weren't disseminating that information. So there was all of this info about how you should handle bullying and what the law says. Because in Ontario, we have something called the Safe Schools Act, which demands that anyone who witnesses bullying, if I'm walking down the sidewalk and I see a kid being bullied on a schoolyard, I am obligated by law to step in and say, you better stop that. But most people don't know that. But when a bystander stops in and says, stop that right now, usually the bullying stops within 7 seconds of someone calling it out. Right? So that's all you got to do. You don't have to go in and peel them off of each other. You just got to go in and say, hey, what you're doing right now is not okay. You need to stop. Most of the time, it will stop within 7 seconds. So we know that that law exists, but how many people in our community are actually aware that there is a Safe Schools Act? How many people are aware of what it says? How many people know what their rights and responsibilities are under the Safe Schools Act? I would argue less than 5%.
Yeah. That's all I got. It's like, I've been having a series of conversations through this podcast and elsewhere lately where I kind of finish feeling overwhelmed and angsty. Like, gosh, there's just so much going on. And these issues are all so interwoven and connected. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a conversation recently about expertise and how that also dovetails into politics and government and trust and social media and the news. And it was like, oh gosh, I just wanted to talk about expertise. And now it seems like, oh, Julie's coming down. Like, we'll just talk about rage and anger. And it's like, oh damn, education system and marriage and social support and laws and
it's all the things. Yeah. It can feel overwhelming. And here's what I would say to that, Jeremy. You know, we are called to be salt and light.
Salted light?
Salt and light.
Okay. I picture that as like a menu item. Like, oh, salted light sounds good. Okay.
Yeah, it kind of does, doesn't it? Salted caramel, salted light. But we're called to be salt and light. And what that means is that as salt, we bring flavor to places that are bland. And as light, we brighten up the darkness, right? And so if we can be salt and light, we can't necessarily be salt and light to the whole world, but we can be salt and light to the world that we live in. And that is, you know, for me, that's my community. So that's the BIPOC community. That's the community of psychotherapy. That's my faith-based community, right? It's my family, the neighborhood that I live in. I can be salt and light here. And so I may be able to impact the school boards that serve my community, or I might be able to serve the school boards across Canada. But either way, I'm going to be salt and light. And if I can do that, the world as a whole may not change, but if each of us bring flavor and we bring illumination to the communities that we serve, then there is a ripple effect, like you say, that happens throughout the world, right? And eventually the world is more flavorful. It is also more filled with light, and there's more connection and there's more community. And that's what I wish.
That's so good. God. Dang, you've like many times in this chat, I'm like, yeah, salt and light to me sounds like a brand or a book title or like an Instagram handle. That's so good.
Maybe, salt. Yeah.
I just imagine framing some of the comments or responses that I've received in my life to my content as being like, oh, I'm just too salty for them. Like, yeah, some people like more salt, some people like less salt, or I'm just a little bit too bright for some people.
Yeah.
I love it. God, that's so good. Salty light. Maybe that's a good spot to wrap this up so we can encourage people to be salt and light. I know that you have the new book coming out, and I know you have an Instagram account, and I know you do not have a PhD yet, but
someone's going to give me one.
An honorary. I mean, you keep doing what you're doing. Like, it seems inevitable that you're just going to be prime minister or something. Where, maybe not, where would you direct people to find more of you? Like,
yeah. So the easiest place to find me, I guess, if you're looking around socials, if you go to LinkedIn, you will find me under my name, Julie Christensen. If you go to Instagram, you will find me at Jules_Christensen, J-U-L-Z or J-U-L-Z, depending on where you live, _Christensen. And so the way you spell my last name is you spell Christian and then add the S-E-N onto the end. That's the easiest way to do that. So you'll find me there. And on Twitter, if you prefer to play with X, you can find me at The Anger Lady.
The Anger Lady. That's Anger right. Lady. I just flash back to first getting an email from you or when we were talking about you coming on the podcast the first time and reading about you of like, oh, she's the anger lady. Like, that's a cool thing. I want to talk to the anger lady. And I'll put to those listening, I'll put links to all that in the show notes. So you can just scroll down and click it and it will take you to where you want to go. But Julie Christensen, thank you so much for coming by again. You are welcome anytime. I just always love listening to you. I feel so lit up.
I feel like talking with you makes me more poetic. I don't
really
know the spoken word thing in you, but the words seem to flow a little bit easier when I'm talking with you. And maybe it's just the kindred spirit thing going on. I don't know, but
yeah, I'll take it
with you. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. I mean, you dropped some fucking bangers today where I was like, yeah, like physiology is not your feelings and the competent and the confident and the like, what's that last one? Salt and light. Like, but yeah, truly, I appreciate the work you're doing in the world too. I think it matters. I think the way you're approaching it from like the strong scientific background and trying to like zoom out while zooming in, it's really difficult to do that work and to write in the way that you do about big complex topics. And I just adore you. I think you're great. And come by anytime. Please keep bringing all the sight, all the salt and all the light. And yeah, let's just have salty light forever. Sounds good.
Thank you so much. It's been a real treat.
Okay, that was Julie Christensen, and I hope you enjoyed that one as much as I did. She's so good and so sharp, and I learned a lot from talking to her. And as mentioned, you could find her on LinkedIn, you can find her on Instagram, you can find her on Twitter, you can buy her new book, The Rise of Rage, which is out now, and I've included all of those things in the show notes, so you can just click one little link and be taken to a magical place. That is how much I care about you. I'm trying to make your life easier. I'm trying to give you the best access to the best information from the best people possible. Thank you for being here. I appreciate you. And you can find me online at Long Distance Love Bombs. I'm on Instagram. I have a weekly newsletter. I do wild events in person all around the world. Thank you for you. Let's make kindness cool. Let's make compassion commonplace. Let's try to cultivate a bit more empathy. Just make the world a little bit better place. I love you.